Hey, good morning, Kieran. How are you?
Good morning, Christina. I'm doing okay. Thank
That's
you.
That's great. Welcome back. And good morning to our listening audience. This is another edition of Tell It Like It Is every Thursday morning from 10 to 11. And this has been quite a wet morning. We're starting a little bit late because of the weather. But thank goodness Sarah's made it in from New York City. And we're all here. And joining us this morning, I'm glad to say, will be the founding director of Filling in the Gaps in American History, Jackie Williams. And we will be talking to her for the rest of the hour. So stay tuned to Tell It Like It Is. Okay, that wawa always gets to me. So, Kieran, I think we have Jackie on the phone with us. Let me see if I can get her to join us. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
So, Jackie, my guest co-host, Kieran O'Reilly, I shouldn't call him a guest co-host anymore because he's been on with me quite often, will be joining us this morning, and he will be... telling us a little bit about who you are. So,
Good morning, Jackie. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
And Jackie, I just want to say, if you can speak louder into the phone, that's the only problem with phone interviews. We can hear you.
I can definitely increase my volume.
Oh, that's great. That's much better. Thanks.
Great. I'm just going to briefly give the intro. Jackie Williams is the founding director of Filling in the Gaps in American History, or FIGA, Incorporated, which researches and shares information on people of African descent who do not usually appear in the textbooks. FIGA has given presentations at area schools, library, the New York State Museum, for churches, community groups, Juneteenth, Kwanzaa, and the African American Family Day celebrations, and tabled at many community events. So thank you for being us. Oh, you're also a principal consultant with J3 Consulting with 20 years of experience in the field of ending sexual violence and conducting trainings on identifying and dismantling various forms of oppression. So thank you so much for being with us again today.
Well, and it's especially great to be on where I can sit at home and didn't have to drive out in this rain to come and be in the studio. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, apparently there's been a lot of flooding. But, Jackie, I want to start off. First of all, I want to tell folks how I met you. I met you at the just about a month ago. I went to the annual Black Cultural Arts Festival put on by Operation Unite and Elena Mosley, who is also the founder and director of Operation Unite. And I met you at a booth there, and you had tons of literature on different folks, personages in African-American history. And I talked to you, and I asked you to be on the show. And you gave me a sense of I'm going to ask you to share with the audience, a sense of what is your organization? I know we just read an introduction, but what prompted you to create this organization, and what is its purpose?
Well, as your co-host mentioned, the purpose, which is the easiest part, is to research and share information about people that most of you, your listeners, have never heard of. And people wonder, why would I want to do such a thing? Now, as a woman of African descent myself, I was born and I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, in a family who thinks that education is a wonderful thing and that history is still with us today, that whatever happened in the past and our ancestors are still with us and their effects. So I grew up hearing stories about what my parents and grandparents did in their youth, where they grew up. And my father is from Alabama, my mother from Detroit, Michigan. My mother was from Tennessee, and they both migrated to Detroit. So their families were part of that northern migration back in the 30s, and learning what life was like growing up on a farm or being in the South versus the North, that was just normal, everyday conversation. Mm. So when I started to go to school and I heard other people's stories or I heard stories from the school books, I kept waiting to hear some of the same things, and I didn't. So So basically, Figure began because I was a very curious child, and I still am as an adult, and I grew up with some knowledge that information wasn't complete. And as I continued through school and I learned about books, about footnotes and endnotes and bibliographies, I would start looking there for black people. So whatever the story was, I said, okay, well, maybe the black people are someplace else, or maybe that there's a reference. And all the way through elementary and middle school, well, high school, college, so I would then share what things I had heard or found out or that I had read, and most people would think, you're kidding, or that can't be true because it's not in a book. So the initial impetus was to acknowledge the fact that books don't contain everything, number one, and number two, people of African descent in this country, for some reason, didn't rate being included. So I would tell stories and share information, and about 10 years ago is when I really thought I need to have an umbrella to put this together and not just the occasional story, and that's when Figure was born.
That prompts my next question, which is why is history important, or why is it important for us to know our own history? Do people disappear, if they're never talked about or marginalized?
Yeah, absolutely. And all the information that you hear about if history was written by the people who lost the wars as opposed to those who won, if the lions wrote the history instead of the hunters. So all history is, it's a story, it's a series of stories. And unfortunately, most of them are his story, because the majority were written by men, and the majority were written in times of triumph and in times of when one culture had overtaken from another. So the perspectives change. And as a person interested in history and the idea of always being able to read more than one person's story, if you were sitting on the right side versus the left side, you had a different view. And in terms of in the Americas, and I wanted to stress the Americas all the way, because Stigler talks about people of African descent in North, South, Central Americas, and Mexico, because we arrived at all of them, and it's not just the United States of America, all of the Americas, and the history of these continents being connected is important. And it's amazing how many people don't realize that there is a contiguous landmass. So those are some of the reasons why the history is important. If you only look at a piece of it, you're only getting that particular piece and not a perspective, and you don't see how they're connected to the rest of it.
Oh, go ahead.
Wow, thank you. This is part of your approach has reminded me a little of another historian, Howard Zinn, who is a complete idol of mine.
Oh, great.
And it's just this idea of telling the story of those who don't make it into the textbooks, telling the story of those who don't necessarily are in a position of power to tell their story of women, of the working class, of you know, various ethnic groups, and so on and so forth. Now, can we talk a little bit about the why that is important? Why should we talk and look for stories of relatively unknown, obscure people? Why would that be an important thing today in this modern age for us to engage in and to also share with our children?
Well, if we don't know, again, the old ad, if you don't know where we've come from, and it's a little tough to go, if you have no idea, of your direction. But if you don't know, first and foremost, that you're only reading part of the story, it doesn't compel you to at least acknowledge it and acknowledge that there are people, and people, plural, whose stories are not included. And if you read something thinking that it's complete or thinking that that's all that there is, you base your decisions on limited information. So the whole notion of being inclusive, even if you acknowledge the fact that I'm going to read a story about little girls today and there are boys in the world. So if all of your stories are about little girls, you step outside and you get shocked that, wow, there are these little girls that are funny looking and they're called boys and I've never heard of them. So your ability to interact with these other people, or people who speak a language different from your own, so people who eat food or worship a different way, or read in a different direction or wear different clothing. So in order for us to be people of the world, and you ask, why would it be important today? Today we are linked in ways that have never happened before throughout the existence of the world, which generally is thought to be a good thing. Part of the bad thing is we are linked with people we have no knowledge of, and unfortunately that sometimes causes us to behave quite badly.
There's an issue also of who is considered important in society, and when you tell the stories of people, let me take a step backwards. We were going to talk also about Martin Luther King today because of the recent statue that has been on the mall, a memorial to the statue built in, to honor King, the monument on the mall, on the Washington, on the National Mall. He is a pivotal figure in history. We all know who he is, but he is one person, and you know, if you just take a second and think about it, that he must have been surrounded by an entire milieu of people, not only of his own milieu, but people who organized around him. He came from a certain historical context, and that whole story you rarely hear. Is that something go ahead.
Well, I want to back up because you asked a series of questions.
Sorry.
it's okay. It's your show. One of the things that you start off asking about, who decides that someone is important, and the notion that your co-host said that all of these people and people that are sometimes considered to be at the margins, depending upon who's in power at the time. So if you consider, I'm going to ask you and your listeners to think about a circle, and a circle, in this case, I want it to stand up so you're facing the circle, and then think about the center of the circle being the center of power. And whoever is at the center of power controls everything that radiates outward. Depending upon where you are, and let's say if that center is in the middle of the circle, and you are on the outer edge, how difficult is it for you to access that power? How far do you have to travel to get to that center, or to be noticed by the center? If we want to think about kind of life and various groups of people in that way, and people very often move in and out from the outer limit of the circle, moving toward the center, and then sometimes the people from the center are radiating outward because somebody else takes the place in the center. So in terms of deciding who's important, most of our beliefs in this country are based upon power. The whole power dynamic is I'm in the middle and I can control, I can pull things one way or the other, for lots of different reasons. So while I am in the center, I get to decide because it's my world. So that answers your question about who decides. How someone gets to be important within this type of a framework is whether someone is a friend or a threat to my being in the center controlling everything else. If I see you as a friend, I'm going to pull you in, keep you close, and expand my sphere, my center of power. If I consider you a threat, I may pull you close just so I can examine you and then push you more forcefully out away from me to make sure that you don't take away anything that I have. And that's part of the power dynamic that's been developed and still exists in this country. If you are a person who is similar to me, I recognize you, and I want you to, emulate me. If you're someone who is different from me in some way, I might want to build up the similarity and ignore the difference. If I pay attention to the difference, I want to push you away. And given that as an example of importance and the whole idea of the center, one of the situations, and we'll get back to King, I know we'll get to that. In terms of power and importance, in this country, money is considered important. I was speaking to an elementary class about cotton and the idea that part of one of the vocabulary words that I was using with them was currency, and another word was Confederate. During the Confederacy, that group of people who seceded from the United States created their own government. They created their own money, their own currency to do business. And one of the children was asked, well, what goes on money? And you say, and they said, something that is important. So things that make a lot of difference. If you look at money for most nations, it has famous, important people, buildings, and concepts. So, okay, so we were looking at Confederate currency. There are two vocabulary words. And for those who've never seen Confederate money, they printed it, it was paper, and they used it even for the dollars and even for the coinage. They weren't coins, the smaller denominations were 25 cents, 50 cents, and they were paper. And paper was decorated with all these important concepts and people. On the Confederate currency, the majority of which had got emblems of cotton and enslaved people carrying or working the cotton. So by inference, the cotton was important to the Confederate economy. Who was working the cotton as human beings were not important, but the labor source of working the cotton was. So in that sense, if you think about the who was important, who was at the center, we had white Southern men, property owners, and what was important to them was the economy. The economy, part of it was based upon cotton and having the labor to work it. So that's kind of a long, convoluted way of getting around to that notion of what's important. And the images of the enslaved people who were working the cotton were distorted images, and distorted in the sense that if you look at the people who are represented, they look healthy. They have teeth, which in the 19th century, that also meant you were healthy. They had a little meat on their bones, so you were, you were well fed. And their clothing was intact. It wasn't ripped or shattered. A great many of them were female, and the men who were represented were very muscular. So I say this was that image of the ideal labor source that they wanted, and the image they were projecting, and perhaps the image that they saw themselves, that these were well-fed, healthy, happy people just doing work for the good of the Confederacy. The idea that these were whole people who were not seen as people, who were not able to make decisions for themselves in terms of their families, in terms of their sexuality, in terms of where they lived, the fact that their work schedule was determined, that they did not earn any money, none of those things were a factor. So in terms of importance, that's one example of someone else's point of view and all that was seen. So you have the two levels. You've got the enslaved people who are represented on the money and represented in terms of being the labor force of a large part of that economy.
Yeah, that's a powerful example of how an instance in history, a part of history, can open your eyes up to the internal workings of power and why things are the way they are. But Kieran, you wanted to ask.
I just actually talking about the Confederacy. I couldn't help but thinking about there's some guy running around town here with a big Confederate flag, beeping his horn really loud. And just got me thinking about that Confederate flag again, and it's pretty amazing that there's somehow a school of thought of the flag wavers who believe that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery. It was more about money and power. Now, the North did, have Lincoln feared the banks, he said, as much as the South, but there's somehow this weird disconnect that the Confederate flag is somehow an act of resistance and rebellion and underdog and sort of a true patriot of the land kind of thing. And they forget about the whole fact of it representing slavery. So I appreciate that example of showing how that flag really does represent a system of slavery.
Well, and that's a perfect example. And if you think about over the last few years, various incidents where that flag has been brought up in terms of what it represents, who it represents. Is it a matter of pride? Is it a matter of shame? And the fact that the story about this country's founding being revolutionary, being rebels, being resistant, that follows that whole theme of somebody is doing something to us, we have the power, we have the right, we're going to fight back, we are rebels, and there is, we're supposed to be proud of that. That is part of the American story. Mm. And to have a flag that represents your side, whether it be, you know, flag football or whether it be, you know, states who seceded, a flag is your emblem, and you are entitled to wave it and to show it, and this is what you represent. So the notion of the Confederate flag and some of those images and some of those positive qualities, there's absolutely nothing wrong with, because that's what a flag does represent. The idea that they lost, okay, so your flag can't be raised to the highest, you've got to be in the second position because you lost. The winner's flag flies higher. The fact that it was based upon enslavement of other people, and for a great number of people, the battle between the states, which is how it's referred to, or the Northern aggression, how it's actually referred to in some Southern textbooks. It's not the Civil War. It's the War of Northern Aggression. So you've got Northern industrialists who are coming to tell us how to run our business and take away our money. And there is a large sense of pride and differentness and nothing about the labor that was used to run the economy. Hmm. Nothing about the people. And so in that sense, it wasn't about slavery, because it wasn't even part of the discussion. It was invisible.
But, you know, this is interesting because it goes to the issue of sanitizing history, or, well, what it goes to the issue is, as you said, the folks in power right now who are still talking about states' rights, which is a lot of what the Civil War was about, also are still talking about it now. There's many people who want to dismantle Social Security and make it optional to each state. And my question is the story of the Civil War is still a story that can be told in different ways to promote certain agendas. And I think that history is constantly being rewritten in a way so that it can promote certain agendas, not the interpretations of the Bill of Rights and our Constitution. It depends on who's looking at it. And how do you address that issue? Because the great importance is that you can have right now history co-opted to feed a certain jingoistic populist movement, such as like the Tea Party and others, you know, versus really understanding the real dynamics of power in this country.
Well, I'd just be very careful, because using words like the real picture, you're moving your own center. Everyone can look at numbers, or everyone can look at a story and use it in whatever way you want to. So, who is one person versus another to say what the real story is? The documents that you mentioned, when the people writing those documents, and we're looking now from a 21st century perspective, knowing all the things that we do know that perhaps they didn't at the time, but it's really important for a person now looking at something that someone else wrote, whether they wrote it with all the information available, whether they wrote it from their own perspective at the time, or whether they wrote it from a group perspective. So the documents that you referred to, and a lot of Americans look at and say, oh, but the Constitution says, and the Constitution this, and the Bill of Rights that. Who was it written for at that time, and who has had the ability or the charge to interpret it since then? The documents in the founding of this nation did not have people of African descent considered. So when we as American citizens or people in this country talk about documents as if they were inclusive, we've got to be very careful. because if women were not included, mm-hmm. if people of color were not included, mm-hmm. if people of various classes were not included, we have to first and foremost, you know, acknowledge that and what it took to put other people in and to use the same document to be considered. So in terms of looking at something, it's always important to say, even for today, if we're looking at a weather report, I'm in the center of Albany at the moment. You're in Hudson. Someone else might be 30 miles in another direction. We're all experiencing similar weather, but there will be different because we're at different distances between the different fronts and all the rest of it. And we're all absolutely correct. So documents that we do use to govern ourselves and to impose rules and regulations and that we beat other people over the head with, or they beat us over the head with, by looking at the time and the place and what was thought, who was thought, and what was thought to be important at the time, that's to me is the most critical factor. And a lot of what FIGA does is looking at documents, reading them, and asking people to take a slight step to the right, to the left, or to look at it in terms of certain people. And so I want to just caution ourselves then, because as soon as we start doing the distance, the us and them, that's very dangerous, because it's trying to put yourself or put anyone else in a static position instead of opening our eyes and looking to see what's actually going on.
Wow! Thank you so much. Are you a professor as well, or you're an educator, right?
The word that I use is an autodidact, and I just love that word. It sounds weird. As you read in my biography, I do presentations and workshops on all of these and similar topics, and this is my real passion. So, as far as am I a professor and educator, as most people consider it, no. As I consider it, since the age of 4, I've always said I wanted to be a teacher. And the fact that if I hear something, I want to share it with somebody else because I think it's fascinating and interesting. And I have in my professional life, a lot of what I've done has been being responsible for teaching and training other people things. In my passion, when I talk about these people and times in history and ways of looking at things. I do it from pre-kindergarten to the end of life, and I am trained in knowing about teaching methods and adult learning styles, children learning styles. So if I tell you a story about the American Revolution and I want you to know about the Black Loyalists, which is a subject that if you were to look at a history book, you won't see. I can do it for you, with you, if you were 3 years old or 103.
Wow.
So in terms of am I an educator, yes, I think we're all educators and we need to be.
Yeah.
Do I have a title of professor? No, I do not.
How would it work if someone was interested in having you or do you have, I don't know if you have other folks that you work with, if an organization or people wanted to have you say speak at the library, how does that work? Are you a nonprofit or?
Well, we could just give some info. Can we share info with people?
Yes,
absolutely. Thank you for asking. Filling in the Gaps of American History is a registered not-for-profit in New York State. At this point, I have to apologize. The website is down. I'm trying to get it reworked. So the best way for people to contact us is they can use the email and info, your basic info, at FIGA, FIGAH.US will reach me, or even Jackie, which is my first name, JACQUI, at FIGA.US will also reach me with a request to say, well, we'd like to know about those Black Loyalists, or who do you know about? Oh, can you tell us about an inventor, or are there any women doctors in the 19th century? And the answer is yes, and we want to know about it. So if someone were to send an email, they can also call area code 518-210-6028 and leave a message if I'm on a telephone interview, as I am right now, or talk about the subject or the questions they'd like covered. There is also a Facebook page, under Filling in the Gaps in American History, the full name. And on Facebook, there are links to various topics. I just posted something yesterday about, I think something in Great Britain, which has some relevancy, or sometimes I'll post information about a cemetery that provided information about the people who were buried there, or a town in Michigan that I never knew about, and I'm from Detroit, Michigan, that was intentionally integrated in the 19th century, where people treated each other as people, and it was a very small township and still exists today. And if people were interested in having a presentation or a workshop or a full-day conference, so calling me, emailing me, and generally I'm the one who usually does the presentations. FIGA is a corporation, so there is a board. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you go to a cultural event or an educational event or a tabling at a school, you will find someone else behind the table. However, I'm the one who does the presentations.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jackie. And we are speaking to Jackie C. Williams, who is the founding director of FIGA. And we are going to take a very quick break, Jackie, so if you can just hang out with us.
And
we'll be right back. Was a little Sam Cooke, and you're listening to
WGXC 90.7 FM. I am Kieran Riley with Christina Malisoff, and we are on Tell It Like It Is every Thursday from 10 to 11 a.m., and we're talking with Jackie Williams, founding director of FIGA, or Filling in the Gaps in American History.
Hey, Jackie, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much. I was enjoying Sam Cooke and the song that you shared. A change is going to come, which was used during a recent presidential campaign.
Which actually, Kieran wanted to ask a question about, was it people, recent people in history, or people that you would mention? I'm sorry, I'm tripping all over.
Go ahead. What's the question?
I was just kind of, I was going to bring up the question, there's two questions. First of all is this approach of looking at history, and there's so much to learn, and I'm so glad you're with us because I'm already learning like so much. There's always the details too, things that I learn all the time. For example, that there was somebody before Rosa Parks who refused to go to the back of the bus that nobody even knows.
A lot of people.
Yeah. And there was, Thomas Edison had an African-American assistant, I believe it was. Was that right? Or somebody was talking about Thomas Edison's assistant, and I was like, it makes you wonder, what were the dynamics of all those inventions and things like that? And I just am wondering if how that segues into understanding our current times and understanding the present situation, the situation of education, of children's consciousness today. And so who would be the unknown figures of contemporary society, the unknown stories, the people in between the gaps, like You know, there's so many in the past, but it makes you always wonder, well, who is it today? You know, what are the civil rights issues of today, for example? And
well, those are great questions, and it does require us going back and forth across time. I'm sitting at my computer, and I just clicked to see what was going to open up. The whole idea that we think about, instead of having that flat circle that I asked you to look at before, if we think about something that's three-dimensional, as the world is, or for some of us we think in four or five dimensions, but it depends on where you are in space. So asking about who are those unknown people, we don't know because they are unknown. What's important, and in terms of educationally and to be a citizen of this country, of this continent, of this world, it's important, I think, the most important thing is to accept the fact that we're not alone. And wherever you are, wherever you stand, wherever you look, to be aware that there are others around. So if you are male or female with a physical limitation of a certain age at a certain economic status, that you know that there are people above, below, to the left, and to the right. And for every person who's in the news, or for every story that you read, there are more. Whether it's a story of a 13-year-old who's going to college, you know, is she unique? Is she special? The fact that the media plays up the story as if being well-educated by a single father is something to acclaim, and it is. That is important. It's a much nicer story than a 13-year-old who was shot by her father. But looking at what were the situations that allowed him to do it, what required him to be a single parent while the mother died, how did he decide to pay so much attention to this child? Well, every parent should pay attention to their child. And educationally, is she a brilliant exception, or is the set of circumstances that she had access to a parent who cared, who was able, who followed her through things to make sure she had access to all the materials, not just the ones that were put in front of her, that she was part of a community who shared that value, et cetera, which is not taking away from her own efforts, but she didn't do it by herself. If you're familiar with Malcolm Gladwell?
No, I don't know the name.
Oh, you need to read Malcolm Gladwell. And one of his books is called Outliers.
Mm.
And the book Outliers talks about all of these exceptions. And we're going to come around to the king. I'm watching the clock.
Yes.
When we talk about the exceptions and the individuals that we lift up as being unusual, whether it's in music or sports or science or anything else, and he goes through a series of case studies that what makes someone a prodigy, well, basically, and his estimation was you've got to get in, I believe it was 10,000 hours of whatever you're doing. If you can get 10,000 hours of practice at music or at solving math problems or doing your chemistry, you can become proficient. The majority of us are not able to put in that amount of time because we're working, because we don't have access to the instruments or the materials, because we don't have a playing field that is kept clean and all of those things. And for those who make it as those exceptions, if you actually work it back, these are people who had access to their parents or community that allows them to develop those skills, who tell them it's a good thing, who value it, have other people that are working so they don't have to while they're practicing, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. So the 13-year-old who goes to college is an amazing young woman, and we need to have more people, not necessarily everybody needs to go to college at 13, but we have to have more people who have access to what she had.
Absolutely.
In order to succeed.
Absolutely.
And those are some things that the Harlem Children's Zone here in Albany, the Albany Family Education Alliance, and other groups have thought about in the education system. You don't have to test a child in the third grade and then decide who's going to be left behind or not. You need to make things available and then to let people, you know, achieve as they can. So the whole notion of exceptionality, which is a very American concept, it isn't universal, and it is part of what's done harm to people who are considered to be at the margins. If you don't give women the vote, it's a little tough to hear their voice. If you don't allow people of color into certain professions, they're not going to achieve competency, earn money, and all of that. If you don't let a person who speaks a language other than English write any of the materials, then people aren't going to learn that language. So who is invisible? Basically, we don't know because we're not paying attention. If you're looking in one direction and you don't turn your head to another, anytime you mention the exception, anytime you mention a Rosa Parks or a Martin Luther King or a Malcolm X, in today's society, you are leaving out a thousand other stories.
That's true, and that's the way we tend to focus on people. But at the same time, the movement of King was the very thing that you were talking about. Is he understood class issues, and he understood the need to fight poverty and to allow access to the majority of people, to allow them access to the things that are needed for people to grow and to have
well,
and to share
was,
in the power.
That was part of his personal progression, because remember, he was a human.
Right.
And at the time he was killed, he was only 39 years old.
Yes.
And for those of us who are now on the other side of that, thinking about where we were, what we believed in, and how we thought the world existed at 39 compared to 49, 59, 69.
Right.
So it's important to acknowledge that he had a progression in his own beliefs.
Absolutely.
As well as challenging others to accept the fact that he had a variety of oppressions that he was aware of, trying to unite and pull together at the time he was killed.
Right. I totally agree. And I think also that's another important part of reading about historical figures is understanding that they did come. They weren't were born with those ideas, but that they struggled in the same fashion that I struggle to learn every day and to have my eyes opened. And that's why when the more you find out about history, the more you're shocked. There's a certain cultural dissonance between what you were taught and what you find out that wasn't taught, you know, other stories, as you say, that weren't heard. But I wanted to go to King because of the recent controversy about the monument on the Washington Mall. Just to let people know who are listening, on Alternet, Maya Angelou stated that that there was a quote that was that came out of context, and that the quote in context was a hypothetical eulogy that King was talking about at his death at the Ebenezer Baptist Church, and he said, quote, "If you want to say that I was a drum major for justice, say that I was a drum major for peace, that I was a drum major for righteousness, and all other shallow things will not matter." And this is versus, "I was a drum major for justice, peace, and righteousness," which is the quote which actually appears on the monument. And Maya Angelou is quoted saying, the quote makes Dr. Martin Luther King look like an arrogant twit. So, of course, this is part of, I think, the commodification and sanitization of King. The other thing to bring up very quickly is this, the major corporate contributors, which are way too many to list. But there has been controversy about the fact that General Motors, GE, PepsiCo, ExxonMobil, J.P. Morgan were all major contributors to the monument. And lastly, I also wanted to read to you and have you comment on something that was written by Cornel West, who's a professor of philosophy, and in the New York Times recently in an op-ed, he said, "The prophetic words of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel still haunt us. The whole future of America depends on the impact and influence of Dr. King. Rabbi Heschel spoke those words during the last year of King's life when 72% of whites and 55% of blacks disapproved of King's opposition to the Vietnam War and his efforts to eradicate poverty in America. King's dream of a more democratic America has become, in his words, a nightmare, owing to the persistence of racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. So I know I read a lot. I just wanted to get that information out there. If you can quote on that, talk about that, Jackie.
Okay. Well, I want to back up. There's one of the things that we've done and you've done in that last segment was, again, introduced a lot of people and a lot of concepts and a lot of things.
Sorry.
You're very inclusive. We're going to need more sessions. The whole idea of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King being memorialized is novel and historic because he is the only... His memorial is the only one of a person of color that is on the Washington Mall. His has not been the only one suggested, and there are a number of other things. So we need to, first of all, comment on how unique and impressive it is and how long it took to get the approval to have a person, singular, of color represented among all those monuments and memorials. And I once knew the number, and I don't know right now. But if anyone wanted to look up to see how many different representations of people and who those people are, what they did, under what period of time. So to have something on the mall is a big, big deal. The fact that they had a celebration planned, it was the anniversary of the March on Washington, I Have a Dream speech, and that was part of the significance of the date for having the unveiling because it did tie in to a moment in history. And that specific moment of that particular speech, and there was a specific phrase in the speech, which was, you know, out of the mountain hews the stone. And if you look at the whole design of the monument, is based upon the speech. So I wanted to say that because all of these pieces fit together, and the pieces which get us back to some of the controversy, and some of the controversy has to do with the fact that who got the bid to create the sculpture, where the material came from, the cost of the monument, which still is not fully paid for, who had to approve of or who had to be paid for the rights to use the image. There are lots and lots and lots of things. So for those who haven't seen the photos, because the celebration had to be postponed due to the hurricane, and all of the thousands of people who had planned to come in from other countries as well as across this country, and Washington, D.C., it was a major, major economic hit as well as a weather hit to have this celebration canceled, postponed. But that's, you know, when we talk about the economics of having a national celebration, is also part of the controversy that, you know, here is a man who was working to unite people, all people, people of classes, people of various, you know, genders and abilities, and here we had this multi-billion-dollar celebration planned. So what he would have thought of the whole weekend, the whole week, all the activities, and who was able to come, and for all of the school children who saved their pennies, and the churches and organizations who rented buses, and hoping to get their deposits back. So in terms of putting all this money into celebrating a hunk of granite as opposed to the work of a person or listening to what the person said and the kind of work that still had to be done, you know, is part of it. And then to read the various inscriptions that are on the sculpture and on the walls that are around it, the actual sculpture is about, 28, 30 feet tall, and then there are two walls of marble, I believe, that have, I forget the number of inscriptions. And the people who were reading the quotes were looking, and one of the people was Maya Angelou, the noted writer and author and speaker herself, and the fact that the inscription is incomplete. And as Christina just read, it's very different when you read what was actually said compared to what was written. And if that was a matter of economy, well, let's just shrink it down because chiseling each word costs money. Or was it someone's intent to say something different? Mm. And without being on the board who made the decision, I don't know. I do know, just as Dr. Angelo, there is it's a very different feeling when you read the entire statement. If you were to say anything about me, then say, you know, I would have been, and the very end of it, and if not, basically be silent, because everything else is insignificant. And that's a very powerful statement. To have the quote be, I was a drum major, well, that's different. That's, you know, that's stating an opinion or a fact, but that's not what he said. And what does it mean to have something now carved in stone, literally, on a monument to a person who was trying to unite people? Sounds like a twit.
This is just, it's so disturbing to me as someone who's studied the history of Martin Luther King fairly extensively. The message and the work that was actually done as juxtaposed against the current conventional mainstream knowledge of the work that supposedly was done and completed. There's this idea of completion with King. He got to Washington, they passed the Voting Act, the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and it was all over. And therefore, it's been kind of commodified and corporatized and, you know, put all over the place. And this struggle is just really continued. And I just wanted to ask this sort of large question. If King had a say in the matter today, how would he want us to recognize and honor him if in Washington, D.C.? What would he want us to do?
Well, and that's a question that I cannot answer, because I am not Martin Luther King.
Right.
This is the year 2011. It's not 1968. And I think anyone who tries to put words in his mouth needs to shut up.
Right.
One of the things I do want to point out, and I am looking at time, as you said, it is very different for someone who has read his speeches, his sermons, who's read his articles when he wrote to newspapers, to the person who just goes and looks at the monument and reads the few words that are there. So the impression that you get is you're not going to learn about the entire man's work. You're not going to learn about the man himself by going to the monument. And you're not going to know what his intention was at that time or what he hoped going forward. As Christina mentioned at the very beginning, you know, he was an opponent of the Vietnam War toward the end of his life. And I'm stressing that. It was toward the end of his life. It wasn't something he spoke about earlier until he realized how all of these oppressions were linked. The need to recognize, become informed, and to become an ally of people who are doing work that you might not see as your passion, but working with and for removing all oppression is critical. So if your particular thing is about the various wars and you fight about the wars and someone asks you to show up for hunger, show up for hunger. If your thing is hunger and someone asks you to show up for housing, show up for housing. If your thing is housing and somebody asks you to come and help out on environmental causes, you need to show up. Because all of these things are linked. And I would hope that someone of King's willingness to learn and to progress and to see the connections, I would hope that those would be some of the stances and some of the things that he would be willing to talk about and write about at this point in his life, because he would be in his 80s. He would be, my uncle is 86, so that means King would be probably about 84. My uncle worked with and marched with Dr. King at that time, which is a whole other story. But if you were to say, and we don't need a Martin Luther King, which is not taking away from him and his life, this gets us back to that exceptionalism. We don't need a leader, an elected official, a minister, a union leader to tell us that we need to look and care for one another. We individuals need to change our focuses, our foci, to be able to say there are lots of different areas where I can make a difference, and it is up to me to work with my brothers and sisters and to recognize that we're all struggling. So I want to get back to that whole exceptionalism. All of these people that I've researched and that I speak on and I love to tell people stories about, were all exceptional. The idea that they lived, they loved, they did amazing things, they were connected to some people that we do know of, and others have no connection to anyone at all. They're just interesting people and fascinating. And others are suffered things in the 18th century that are still going on in the 21st century. That, you know, it's huge, it's monumental, that the human condition, have we progressed? In some areas, yes. In terms of oppression and civil rights, I would actually say no. Mm-hmm. The Voting Rights Act and the acts of 1964 and 65, we've lost ground instead of gaining.
Jackie, I couldn't agree with you more. It's a very deep and universal truth that you're speaking, that you just, you know, laid out for us just now. And I would very much like, first of all, to thank you for being on today. And I would also like to ask you back to be on the show again at some point in the near future. And also, I believe you are also sponsoring speakers in the Albany area. So in the next 30 seconds, if you wanted to tell us about what you have on your agenda. If
thanks for remembering that, because
yes.
I almost forgot.
Yes.
One of the things that filling in the gaps in American history that I'm not, as I say, I do most of the presentations and the workshops. I'm very honored to be one of the sponsors to our noted author, Professor Dorothy Roberts. Is going to be coming to the Capital Region in October. She will be speaking at the main Albany Library, which is on Washington Avenue, on Saturday, October 22nd, from 2 to 4 o'clock. She'll be in the main auditorium, and she'll be speaking on her new book, which is called Fatal Invention, and it's looking at race and how it relates to politics, health, and society in the 21st century. And the title refers to the fact of race being a fatal invention because it is a social construct. So Dorothy Roberts is a professor at Northeastern University in Washington, D.C., and will be at the Albany Main Library on Saturday, October 22nd.
Okay, all Jackie, right. Thank you. We really have to run, but again, go ahead, Karen.
Thank you again for joining us so much. Jackie Williams from Filling in the Gaps in American History with information at info@figa.us. Thank you for being with us. It's Tell It Like It Is. I'm Kieran Riley with Christina Malisoff, and I hope to talk to you again, Jackie.
Okay,
all right, Jackie.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Thank you.
This is Bill McKibben from 350.org, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 on your FM dial, ACRA.
WGXC founding underwriting support is provided by Hawthorne Valley Association, Harlemville, New York, a diverse educational nonprofit set on a 400-acre working farm in central Columbia County. Farm store, early childhood through grade 12 Waldorf school, and more. For more information, www.hawthornvalleyassociation.org.
September 11th. Talk about their significance and
this
understanding
is Al Jazeera,
this 10th anniversary
on the Pacific
of
Radio
September
Network.
11th,
this
course,
is
the one that the
Al Jazeera.
World does know about, September 11th, 2001, when 3,000 people were killed in an instant in New York and in Washington.
Welcome
in
to the News Hour. I'm Shakuntala Santarun in Doha. The top stories.
I have several thoughts about this. The first is that we have September 11th happening every day, everywhere. In other words, there are constantly acts of terror against the people, against the innocent people. And we have to understand that we need to get out of the September 11th sort of syndrome. I'm using this as a metaphor, right? It turns out that that day is very significant because it brings together these two events in Chile and the United States, which are similar, the Tuesdays, the bombs from the air, the terror, etc. But as Aristide just pointed out, and as Helen Mack pointed out, and as Arun Gandhi pointed out, There are other September 11ths as well. So that's the first thing I would say is let's remember that. A second issue has to do with...
Sorry, folks, we're getting Al Jazeera on in just a moment. Stay tuned.
50 and older. Are you uninsured? The Columbia Green Cancer Services Program offers free cancer screening tests. You could be eligible for free clinical breast exams, mammograms, pap smears, and colon tests. There are many local doctors to choose from. To find out more, please call the Cancer Services Program at 518-822-8741. Early detection is the best prevention. The Columbia Green Cancer Services Program is a program of the Healthcare Consortium and is funded by the New York State Department of Health Cancer Services Program.